This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Americans are already being tracked by transaction, by camera, by computer. But there's much more surveillance and potent new technology now being pushed for widespread deployment in the United States. There was a time not long ago when Americans wouldn't hear of it. Privacy and freedom were closely linked. Then came September 11th. And in the scramble to make America safer, privacy suddenly doesn't seem quite so important to some. This hour, we'll look at what privacy advocates call the slippery slope to national security. First, should the U.S. government issue every citizen a national identity card? The idea is gaining ground, and it's drawn support from some unlikely quarters. Special correspondent Jonathan Saltzman reports.
I need that man if you're drinking.
It's 8 o'clock at night, and two burly bouncers are inspecting the driver's licenses of college-age customers entering Lupo's Heartbreak Hotel, a music club in downtown Providence. They want to make sure that everyone who plans to drink alcohol is at least 21. None of the fresh-faced customers who have come to see a performance by Beanie Man gives the ritual a second thought. In fact, many already have their licenses in hand when they enter the door. Every day, millions of Americans nonchalantly show identification to buy a drink, cash a check, take a flight, even rent a video. More often than not, the preferred identification card is a driver's license with a photo ID. But since the terrorist attacks on September 11th, many Americans say it's too easy to get phony identification or to get bona fide identification fraudulently. Investigators say that as many as 5 of the 19 terrorists who hijacked 4 commercial jets fraudulently obtained driver's licenses or state IDs. Robert Walker, one of the bouncers at Lupo's, knows how easy it is to fake driver's licenses. He gladly shows 50 phony licenses that he confiscated at the last show at the nightclub. He collects several more this night, including one from a young blonde man wearing a bright blueprint shirt.
Where'd you get this ID from?
From DMV in Pawtucket.
Yeah? You got something else with another ID? Because this is a fake ID.
Given the apparent role phony ID cards had on September 11th, some people have called for a measure that would have been nearly unthinkable before, national identity cards. Some 100 nations, including Greece, Belgium, Sweden, and Israel, have them. Proponents say America's cards could include basic data, like the holder's name and address, plus a photograph and so-called biometric information, a digital record of thumbprints or an eye retina scan. Americans traditionally bristle at the prospect of government officials asking, "May I see your papers, please?" It evokes Big Brother and totalitarian regimes, like apartheid South Africa, which used national identity documents to subjugate the black majority. But in this new fearful world, recent polls have indicated widespread support for the idea. A Pew poll in September found that 70% of Americans supported it, as did 60% of those questioned in a Time CNN poll and 73% in a Minneapolis Star Tribune poll. A national identity card has drawn praise from such politically diverse sources as Paul Wolfowitz, President Bush's Deputy Secretary of Defense, and Alan Dershowitz, the Harvard University law professor and self-described civil libertarian. Dershowitz says he'd always opposed the notion until the terrorist attacks, when he questioned what he called his knee-jerk view.
When I started to think about why am I against identity cards, national identity cards, I really couldn't come up with a good reason. It occurred to me that 99.9% of law-abiding Americans have IDs that we were asked to show from time to time. If whatever Thoreauian Walden Pond concept of anonymity we may have idealized in the 19th century long ago disappeared with the income tax and Social Security cards, etc.
A national identity card was not part of the anti-terrorism package overwhelmingly approved by Congress recently. But some members of Congress say it's worth discussing. And groups that want to crack down on illegal immigration have long advocated a counterfeit-proof card that shows that someone is living in the United States legally. Jack Martin, a spokesman for the Washington-based Federation for American Immigration Reform, says a national ID card poses no threats to precious freedoms enjoyed by law-abiding citizens.
The whole issue of civil liberties basically is a red herring in this particular debate. People already have their identity document in a driver's license or in a state-issued identity card, and they also have to have their Social Security number for purposes of employment.
But critics of the idea, like proponents, come from across the political spectrum. They include the American Civil Liberties Union, the National Rifle Association, Phyllis Schlafly, and privacy advocates. Several detractors say the history of the Social Security card is instructive. The card was originally intended to show that its holder was entitled to Social Security benefits. But today, people are asked for their Social Security numbers by businesses, schools, banks, and countless government agencies. Nadine Strossen, executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, says that was never the intent of the bill that created the Social Security system during the Depression.
We've seen constant hydraulic pressures to use the Social Security ID for more and more purposes. I think the temptation to do that with the new national ID card, there are just going to be irresistible pressures to use it for other policy purposes that people consider to be important.
Opponents of a new national ID card fear the government could somehow ultimately use it to track gun owners, deadbeat dads, witnesses at a crime scene, even people who are HIV positive. And it would extend what some critics call surveillance creep. Robert Ellis Smith is the publisher of the Privacy Journal, a monthly newsletter on privacy in the computer age.
It is simply inimical to the American experience of having freedom of movement from one state to another, which our Supreme Court has recognized for years and years. In addition to that, there is a constitutional right to privacy and a constitutional right to anonymity that would be infringed by this. It would mean that you'd have to have your papers in order before you went out to jog in the park or to walk on the streets.
Apart from the issue of civil liberties, critics question how effective a national identity card would be in preventing something like the terrorist attacks. For one thing, there's no guarantee that someone couldn't make a counterfeit card. And just because a cardholder is who he says he is, doesn't mean he's not a terrorist. Nadine Strossen of the ACLU says there are much better ways to improve aviation security.
What we have had masquerading as aviation security in this country really is a joke. For anyone who has traveled internationally, that's quite apparent. And interestingly enough, very shortly after the September 11th attacks, the ACLU actually issued a press release saying ACLU welcomes new aviation security measures as being the best of both worlds, something that would really improve national security and personal safety with no cost to in terms of individual civil liberties.
Congressman Maurice Hinchey, a Democrat from upstate New York, agrees. He says Americans should pause and take a deep breath before they consider sacrificing hard-earned liberties.
I'm just concerned that we do not do things that are precipitous and that have not been thought out carefully that might lead us down a road that could be dangerous. It would be a deep irony if we lost some of the freedoms and liberties that we're trying to protect as a result of our reaction to these attacks.
Hinchey says there's no significant support for national identity cards in Congress right now. If people start pushing for it, opponents might fight back with something that Ben Franklin said more than 200 years ago. Those who wish to sacrifice liberty for perceived security deserve neither. For WBUR Special Coverage, I'm Jonathan Saltzman.
This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about new surveillance technologies and the willingness to trade privacy for better security. How far are you willing to go? You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us this evening is Jeffrey Rosen. He's associate professor at George Washington University Law School and legal affairs editor of The New Republic. Good evening, Jeffrey Rosen.
Very nice to be here.
Good to have you. Also with us is Joseph Attuck, founder and CEO of Visionix, a face recognition technology company based in New Jersey. Good evening, Joseph Attuck.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. And speaking with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack. It's good to be back at the mic with you.
Hi, Tom.
We're talking about privacy and where it's headed after 9/11 and where new technologies may take us. Jeffrey Rosen, you've written very compellingly about this, most recently in the New York Times magazine in an article called A Watchful State. What is your assessment? What's the state of American privacy today, and where is it headed post 9/11?
Britain may be an instructive example on this score. In Britain, surveillance cameras were installed primarily as a magic bullet against terrorism, and that's the way that they were sold. But very quickly, one saw that they were used not to catch terrorists, but to enforce low-level forms of social control. It was really quite striking for those of us who remember the different age before September 11th, when there was powerful American opposition to surveillance cameras, how quickly the public mood can shift. And again, in Britain, the thing about the cameras is they're astonishingly popular. 70-80% say that they're not Big Brother at all. They're a kindly and friendly eye in the sky. So I think we really want to think very closely in the face of new polls suggesting that in America, support for surveillance cameras is quite strong.
So, about
what exactly we're getting into.
So you're pointing first to surveillance cameras as one new thing that may be coming on stream in the U.S. In Britain, how widespread is the presence of surveillance cameras?
It's really quite remarkable. The estimates are hard to come by just because people have stopped counting. One estimate says 2.5 million cameras in the country. Another says that the average Briton is photographed by perhaps 300 separate cameras a day. But when I was there, I was just struck by how pervasive they are. They follow you as you get out of the airport. They watch you on the subway. They peer at you from the back of buses. They look at you from hotels and restaurants. It really is amazing how quickly. It was really in 1993 that the cameras began to proliferate, and very quickly they're being billed as what some call the fifth utility after gas, electricity, telecommunications, and sewage. Closed-circuit television cameras, according to some, will become the fifth utility, a linked network that can appear at us at all times.
And we hear that's just the beginning technologically. Joseph Attuck, your company has emerged as a leader in face recognition technology, which takes, I guess, the image from a camera and goes further with it. What exactly does your technology permit security authorities to do?
Well, we have to be actually careful about the distinction between CCTV cameras and
closed
facial
circuit
recognition.
Okay.
Facial recognition is basically the capability of a computer system to automatically analyze faces appearing in front of standard cameras, but not visible necessarily to other human beings. Computers will be looking at those faces in front of cameras, analyze them, and match them against a watch list of known terrorists or criminals. It doesn't identify you or me. It does not track you or me. It simply alarms a law enforcement official or a security guard should there be somebody on a watch list appearing in a public facility like an airport or a border or a stadium.
But you've warned members of Congress, yourself, I believe, in testimony that it could be misused and transgress privacy. How would that happen?
Well, the key to facial recognition and responsible use of facial recognition is the control of the watch list. If we make sure that those watch lists are truly watch lists of terrorists and criminals and not simply people who, because of their ethnic background or their religious background, they've been added to the database. Mm. If we simply control the databases, then there's no way you can invade anybody's privacy.
It sounds like it would be easy to misuse it, though. Jack Beatty, do you, Jeffrey Rosen talked about the quick turnabout in American public opinion. Do you feel that? Do you think Americans are ready to accept the risk of invasions of privacy they've never felt before?
Well, you know, if we look at this from the perspective of the people in the buildings in the Twin Towers, mm-hmm. I think we see it somewhat differently. Britain remains one of the freest societies in the world. This facial recognition business, I mean, I would if facial recognition would have kept Mohammed Atta or other of his people from getting on those planes, they can look at my face, they can X-ray me till the end of time.
Mm, mm.
I mean, I really think we have to sort of play it back from the people in the buildings.
We're going to do it this hour. We're playing it back. How much privacy would you give up not to go down in the Twin Towers or to avoid something like that for someone else in the future? You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or join online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about surveillance, privacy, and how much of it we're willing to give up to be more secure from terrorism. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jeffrey Rosen, you heard our news analyst Jack Beatty just before the break saying he would give up a fair bit of old-fashioned privacy to be spared the kind of fiery death in the World Trade Center that so many people had to face. What's the answer to that? Do we have to surrender liberty or privacy for security?
Who of us wouldn't give up privacy to avoid being killed in the World Trade Center? Of course, 8 out of 10 Americans sensibly say that they would make that choice. My concern is that we make a good bargain and that we not give up the privacy and find that we've gotten little increased security in return. I was struck by what Joseph Attuck said on this count, and I greatly respect Dr. Attuck, who I think is both a thoughtful technologist and also is very sensitive to the dangers of this technology. But he said properly that the crucial question is the contents of the database. If it's limited to suspected terrorists, then the guilty are singled out and the innocent are spared. But what the experience of every country that's implemented this technology has shown so far is that because so few terrorists are known in advance, 22, 30, a tiny watch list, mm-hmm. the countries have tried to justify their tremendous investments in this technology by putting in the database those offenders who the authorities actually know. And these are low-level offenders. At the Florida Super Bowl last January, when face-scanning technology was installed to scan everyone who entered, the names that struck matches in the database were not terrorists. They were low-level ticket scalpers and pickpockets because mm-hmm. the contents of the database were the people who the local authorities actually knew. So my great concern is that every experience we have suggests that these databases grow and grow. And then, of course, we face a very real specter that one, just as your excellent correspondent discussed in the debate over the national ID cards, one really loses the right to be anonymous, not only at airports, but in public spaces. Do we want to live in a world where we move through Times Square and are instantly identified and compared with the database of our past offenses? If Dr. Attuck, if everyone were as rational as he, then the databases might be limited. But my sense is that politics is not limited by this sort of rationalism, and I'm not concerned that it's a good bargain.
What about that, Jack Beatty? We're looking then for a more sophisticated balance here. I think we all can understand that. But you heard the quote from Benjamin Franklin earlier on in the report. There has been a link between privacy and anonymity and freedom. In fact, it's been seen as quite close. Are you willing to break that link?
No. But I think we have to really, look at this not as the sort of the old debates about privacy and freedom. There's something else in the mix. The openness of our open society is at once our virtue and our vulnerability. It's a little bit like the Japanese cities, you know. They were made of wood. And when they dropped the firebombs and they just burned up, that was a vulnerability. So is our openness. And it quickly becomes a shibboleth to protect our openness, but at the same time, we're protecting our vulnerability. And I think a new vocabulary, really, of security has to be devised where the shibboleths just don't automatically, freeze debate about what can really be done. I mean, you know, in the end, as John Gaddis, the historian, said on our program last night, mm-hmm. our enemy here, it's about beliefs. It's about hateful thoughts that people have. God knows how we can find the people with these thoughts. But for example, there are these religious schools all over the Middle East. They teach people this, you know, viciously cartoon vision of the world. Do we want people with these mindsets coming to this country? I mean, I think we have to really think about the whole picture here because we're up against an adversary we have seen who has no moral limits whatsoever.
Well, these are pretty stark terms you're laying it out in. Joseph Attuck, you're right in the middle of this, and let's look at your technology in particular. And once again, we see how science can bring us new options and protection, but it can also bring us new threats. You've been very outspoken in saying the very technology you've represented could be misused. What are the guidelines that you would propose the country follow if and when it begins to deploy face recognition scanning surveillance more widely?
We have been pushing for three basic guidelines. First of all, public awareness. The public has to be informed about the presence of these systems in place. We don't want the government to be using it without our knowledge.
Second, is it using it now without our knowledge? It did in Tampa, didn't it?
No, it was in the Ybor City installation. The signs are all over the place. The Super Bowl installation was not done with our technology. We would not have gone into that because it did not inform the public in advance.
Okay, so first is inform the public when they're being observed.
Inform the public. Throughout London, you'll see signs informing the public as well. Second, no match, no memory. That is a very important principle in my mind and one that I will insist on, which is if I'm walking in front of this camera and my face does not match a terrorist and I do not set off an alarm, there should be no permanent record of my face being kept and for any other purposes. Third,
is there any way that we can prevent that happening? Is there legislation that prohibits that?
Well, pending the presence of legislation, I have built in our technology, our company has built technical measures in place that prevent the development of records and the storage of those records from the FACET system. So right now, with our product, no one will be able to do that. But we're asking Congress, of course, to make that the law of the land. Third, the notion that databases have to be justified. They have to include elements which are known threats to society. Fact is, and I want to disagree a little bit with Jeff on this issue, terror is not faceless. Terrorists are indoctrinated over a long period of time. They go to schools. They need to be reinforced. And this gives ample opportunity for intelligence agencies to actually find them, track them, have photographs of them. In fact, three of the terrorists that made it into the United States, we had pictures of them in advance of the event. And we could have actually been able, had we had a system in place that would check faces, would have been able to identify these individuals.
So what about that, Jeff Rosen? Would technology have been the answer here?
I really find we have no example of technology catching a terrorist. England installed cameras for the express purpose of catching terrorists, and although they don't use face recognition technology, they use license plate recognition technology. When I asked the City of London, which installed a so-called ring of steel of cameras to check the license plate of every car that went into the city to catch terrorists, they said they hadn't caught a single one in
So you're saying we might give up our privacy but not the security we're looking for?
Precisely so. I mean, if we're talking about 22 people, presumably they're quite capable of disguising themselves. There's still not total accuracy of the cameras. A study by the Department of Defense found failure to establish matches a third of the time. And to install an entire architecture of surveillance to really change the character of public spaces for the purpose of catching 22 people who presumably Air Force security agents could have physical pictures of them and be trained to look for them. If that's really the only thing we're talking about in the database, I can't imagine that the cameras would be so limited, and they haven't been anywhere else in the world.
Joseph Attic, what about it?
Yeah, actually, 2 points. One key area is, while in London they may have not caught any terrorists using the license plates, ask them how many potential attacks they would have prevented. You put a lock at your door, you keep the burglars out. You prevent them from doing so. The vulnerability is removed. Therefore, terrorists try to go elsewhere. They try to go somewhere where they don't have that mechanism in place. Mm. So don't underestimate the value of deterrence. In fact, police does this all the time.
Deterrence, yeah.
Deterrence is very important. If you make it clear to the terrorists that they should not try to enter this country because we have mechanisms to spot them, they will not try. Second, which is a key important element, databases that are kept by the Interpol, which pools information from various agencies around Europe and the civilized world, from Asia and the Middle East, exceed the hundreds of thousands of images. Actually, we're not talking about 22 people only. Those were just simply the PR photo opportunity that we saw last week and was published just for the public to see.
The most wanted. Gentlemen, we want to get some callers in here. There are many stacking up, and let us turn to the phones. We're talking about privacy and the limitations that new technology may put on it. Are you willing to accept that for the sake of security? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Bill is calling from Woonsocket, Rhode Island. Welcome, Bill.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Very interesting topic. I'm the owner of a company called LittleBearCam.com. We just signed our first customer in Whitensville, Massachusetts.
What does it do?
Well, it's webcams. It's we're going into daycare centers with an extension of their open door policy, putting in webcams so parents can log in and be closer to their children.
So I could watch from work and see how my child is kicking over the building blocks or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Anything all day long, you just leave the window open. We've tested this market for about 9 months, and we're a brand-new company based out of Rhode Island. And
so how do the workers like it in those centers to be observed all day, remotely, invisibly by parents?
Well, the workers at first, you know, they're intimidated by a camera being there. But once it was explained to them that it is an extension of the open door policy to, you know, parents should be able to walk in, see their kids any time of the day, you know, and that's very much a major factor in recruiting new parents, like our open door policy.
Sure.
So this extension of it, they looked at it as log in any time and you're here.
But, Bill, would you say then, would you be in favor of extending that to let the government have a webcam on the entire society all the time?
Well, it's interesting what the other gentleman was saying about England. They don't have the face recognition in England, but they look at license plates. Any terrorist is not going to... They're going to rent something, and they're going to drive in with a bomb, you know, and a rented vehicle. You had no way of tracing a license plate. The face recognition, I read about this a few years ago in Tampa when they first started, and I was quite amazed at the technology. And it seems like Big Brother's watching, but look at what happened where 6,000 people have died in our country, a waste of, you know, precious lives.
It's a terrible price to pay. Bill, thank you for your call. Jeffrey Rosen, what about it? What is the effect of people feeling that they're always being observed or thinking they might always be observed? Joseph Attuck says it's good to deterrent as a deterrent. What are the side of other effects of it?
Could I say a word about that?
I'm
sorry, I didn't hear if you asked.
This is Jeffrey Rosen, yes, please.
Yes, indeed. This is what I was most struck about in England, the way that people behave differently under the cameras, and it's a subtle effect. People describe to me the way ordinarily you feel innocent unless proven guilty. When you're unsure about whether you're being watched, you constantly feel guilty until you demonstrate your innocence to the cameras. So just as the gentleman talked about how people in workplaces behave differently when they're watched, studies have showed that people are less creative, efficient, even eccentric, because it's a form of social control. In Britain, people describe to me the way that you hold your merchandise in Walmart up to the cameras to prove you haven't stolen it. Similarly, on the street, they'll spurn, you know, advances to buy drugs very dramatically because they're unsure about whether they're being watched. This is a subtle but crucial transformation that's characteristic of complete control societies. And do we really want to change the character of public spaces so that people constantly feel that there's some kind of imputation of guilt?
Joseph Attuck, we know we're going to lose you in a minute. Let us know before you go, how close are we to having this technology widely deployed or significantly deployed?
Well, when we talk about facial recognition at airports and in transportation centers, I would expect that this would be imminent. But again, this is not CCTV cameras where everybody's being watched, where everybody's being tracked. No one is going to be looking at the video. These are specialized types of cameras that only analyze a face, and they don't even send the video feed to a control room. Only if there's a match will there be an image associated with the face with the match.
We understand that, but that sounds like, in a way, the old slippery slope. I mean, it would be capable, would it not, of ultimately recording every face and then be able to track us wherever we are anytime?
Well, what if Congress had the oversight responsibility to make sure that that is not the law of the land? What if we assured the public that we can deliver to them security without taking away any cost to their privacy? I mean, this is the argument that we have to keep in mind. Terrorism is real. The fear of the slippery slope is a theoretical concept that we can address through proper policy and through proper dialogue with everyone. And that's where it is at right now. It's reality versus theoretical arguments. We could do this. We could do a lot of things to abuse power in this country. Mm-hmm. That's why we have oversight.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Joseph Attuck, CEO and founder of Visionics, a face recognition technology company based in New Jersey, thank you very much for taking the time to join us this evening.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, what about it? I hear you coming out saying maybe we have to give up some privacy, maybe we shouldn't get so uptight about it, but are you really confident that the government will use its oversight in a restrained way, that the kind of Big Brother scenarios won't unfold?
No, I'm not confident at all. I mean, that to me is the big, who controls the database? It's the old Platonic problem of, who's going to rule? It may well be that it isn't so much Orwell who's our prophet as Kafka and the Joseph K. in the trial, who's on trial for what crime he doesn't know, observed by what people he doesn't know, that he may be the image we're heading toward. That's frightening. No one wants that. But I'm just even at the extreme talking about these cameras. I mean, God knows I don't want that. And yet, one of the things we've found in this country in recent years is that order maintenance measures in cities actually reduce crime, and they make it possible for the cities to become not less but more livable.
You're talking about not letting the broken windows stay, and so things don't crumble on down in the neighborhood.
That's right, and the public spaces can be inhabited again by people. Now, if a few cameras in a park are going to allow, an elderly couple to take an evening stroll without worrying about being mugged, I don't know that I'm against that.
Jack, let's get another caller in here. We're at 1-800-423-8255. How much privacy are you willing to surrender for security? Ron is on the line. Welcome, Ron.
Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I'm sure this is an opinion of a minority of one. I've long felt this way. The events of September 11th bring it into stark contrast. I believe that in an open society, a law-abiding citizen needs no privacy. An absence of privacy is not an absence of civil liberties. Mm. And I don't think if we have total surveillance and national ID cards and everything goes on the record and is open, I don't think that means of having a big brother, but a society of brothers and sisters. As in a family where there's no real privacy, that's what our society would be like. I say let's get the national ID cards with mag strips, with photo IDs, and every bit of information we can get on there.
We got it, Ron. And it's clear tonight that you are not a minority of one. What about it, Jeffrey Rosen? You hear this kind of willingness to step up and take just about whatever measures the government wants to come down with.
You do indeed. This mantra, nothing to hide, nothing to fear, was a very powerful slogan in Britain, and Ron states it very powerfully as well. I guess, Ron, you issue a challenge, which is how can I try to persuade you about the cost of such a society? Imagine, if you will, a group of faceless people behind the cameras watching you without your notice. So I sat in these rooms and watched a male operator zoom in on women voyeuristically, comment on the most intimate aspects of their bodies. I watched minority men were singled out because they looked unusual. So one affront of the world you describe is a world really without dignity when people can be surveilled without their knowledge. But another cost, which I think is an American cost, is that the world you describe is not consistent with the values of an open society. You talked about openness and transparency, but in fact these technologies of ID cards and biometrics are technologies of classification. They decide who gets in and who gets out. If you've committed some minor offense long ago in your past, you're suddenly evaluated against it everywhere that you go and are denied entrance to public buildings, denied jobs, denied the opportunity to escape your past. So
Jeffrey Rosen, we've got to take a break. We'll come back to it. Ron, thank you for your call. We're talking about privacy, about the new technologies that are being aimed at your privacy right now. Do you welcome them in the wake of September 11th, or are you concerned that they may erode our civil liberties, our lifestyle, our understanding of ourselves and our society? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. How much privacy do you need now? I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about privacy in an age of terror and trying to come to a more sophisticated balance in what we're willing to give up for security. We'd like to hear your views. We're at 1-800-423-8255. George is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Welcome, George.
Thank you. In the last 45 days, I've had what the current cultural term is an epiphany. I used to think that I could sit on my porch with my rifle and defend my home, and I would be prepared to defend my neighbor. But all of a sudden, I've discovered that I am inadequate, and I'm too old to fight and too much of an American to roll over. So I must rely on the government. Now, I cannot expect the government to defend me if I am not allowing their defense to be efficient. So therefore, I am prepared to surrender a certain degree of liberty in identification in exchange for the security of having those individuals that would harm me identified and taken out before they can.
George, you speak to it very clearly. Stay with us. I want to ask Jeffrey Rosen to address you directly here. Jeffrey Rosen, here's American citizen, Madison, Wisconsin. His rifle on the front porch isn't going to be enough to protect him anymore. What's your response to George?
Well, it's a wonderful challenge. And indeed, rifle owners and the National Rifle Association have been strong defenders of privacy in the great terrorism debate that we've had in the Senate recently. So I very much respect his challenge. I guess I would say, sir, wouldn't you want strong evidence that you actually were going to be made more secure rather than victimized by a feel-good technology that would create the illusion of security and would be used to surveil the innocent and to spare the guilty? I was struck, Jack Beatty struck a similar chord when he said, you know, if it makes crime go down, if we can reduce the terror, then let's have it. What is so interesting about these cameras is that people who've examined them impartially have found no convincing correlation between the installation of the cameras and decline of crime. It's really funny. When crime goes up, the cameras get credit for detecting it, and when crime goes down, they get credit for preventing it. But in fact, you know, violent crime in Britain rose by 4.3% this year, even though the cameras continued to proliferate. So I guess just as simply as possible, I would say, doesn't it seem counterintuitive to you that really, if it's just a handful of people that are being looked for, that these the best way to find them is to scan every citizen in the country? The technology isn't really that efficient right now. A couple of years ago, it couldn't even distinguish between a man and a woman. I guess all I'd say is I very much respect your desire to be pragmatic and patriotic about this, but just make sure you're getting enough in response for the precious rights that you're giving up.
What about it, George? Are you willing to give up some privacy even for imperfect protection?
I feel that I am part of a society that is a republic. I carefully elect or carefully vote for whom is elected. I am not always successful in electing the individual that I would prefer, but I vote because I believe that their oversight will protect me from the ravishes of an uncontrolled government who wishes to control me.
George, you speak to it eloquently, and we thank you for calling. Jack Beatty, I've got to put you on the spot here. I just know that you would look back at the McCarthy era, at the abuses of the J. Edgar Hoover FBI. George is saying, I elect my representatives and I put my faith in them. But you know the history, Jack. So what does history tell you about the threat as we prepare to accept greater invasions of privacy?
Well, it's not a pretty picture. In every war, civil liberties have suffered, and they've lasted. I mean, in the Cold War, to which the current conflict is being compared, there were sort of chronic violations of civil liberties. People's beliefs, the people were punished for their beliefs. Teachers lost their jobs, actors their roles, directors their shots, newspaper columnists their work for their beliefs. So it's not a pretty picture, and I can't stand on history and say, well, it worked in the past. It didn't. Mm-hmm. All I'm saying is we're in an unprecedented position here. You know, war in the 20th century had a terrible moral innovation, which was war on civilians. Mm-hmm. Well, now we got something else. It's the civilians making war on the civilians, and with weapons of mass destruction.
It's ugly.
And somehow we have to think anew here to be able to deal with the new situation. And for example, Jeffrey Rosen, in your piece in The New Republic talking about the terrorism bill, you point out how the terrorism bill doesn't go far enough in key instances. And you give a frightening example of what would happen if the FBI got a – well, you tell the story.
Jeffrey Rosen, please.
Yes, thanks for flagging it. And it's true. The point of that was that rather than focusing on these feel-good technologies, let's think about the threat. The FBI gets an anonymous tip that a red van has just dumped chemical weapons into the Central Park Reservoir,
okay,
and it's leaving the scene of the crime. according to current Supreme Court doctrine, it's not entirely clear, but my reading is that because the alleged crime is already completed and the tip would be to investigate it rather than prevent it, the FBI would be powerless to act. And I suggested that as a result, we might think about empowering the Attorney General to authorize searches on less than the kind of cause we'd require for low-level crimes when we have really serious allegations of terrorist attacks that wouldn't justify searches ordinarily. So I'm not at all coming here to say that we don't have to make just the balance that Jack Beatty is striking. Of course, we should give up some liberties. We should have creative new mechanisms for targeting our resources on the most serious threats. Mm. I'm just not persuaded by some of these technologies that are being offered, and I want them to be effective.
We're talking about privacy and how much may be given up to protect security. Call at 1-800-423-8255. John is on the line. Welcome, John.
Good evening. I vote for my representatives, but I put my faith in me.
Trust but verify, Ronald Reagan said.
Well, I don't want to side with that, but I agree with it. This whole conversation is very interesting. The thing I want to get at is this could go run amok if you can isolate the surveillance. Surveillance could be isolated where it should be isolated. Corporate IDs are required for corporations, for, you know, Microsoft, and if you work for those companies, you have to have an ID to get in and out.
So where should we target our surveillance if we don't know where the terrorists are?
I buy a plane ticket, and I expect the FAA and the airlines and Logan International to protect me because I bought that ticket. But I don't need a national ID card. I don't need to be identified wherever I go. Government is responsible for roads, buildings, you know, construction, things like that, and national defense.
But not for tracking you.
Not for tracking me.
Thanks for your call, John. We got your point. Let me put it to Jack Beatty. Jack, we're looking for who is in our system going to protect these principles of liberty that do require some defense around privacy. I mean, do you think that with this kind of public sentiment that we've heard some of tonight and with anthrax in Congress, that Congress is going to be that defender?
I just don't know. I'm noting some things, though, and that is that somehow Pat Leahy, whom I regard as a fine public servant, who was in Vermont here, an attorney general, who prosecutor who knows about crime and fighting crime, he has become a kind of villain for the Wall Street Journal and for the Weekly Standard because he has been trying to protect our civil liberties in Congress. Isn't this something, Jeff? The way Pat Leahy, crime fighter, is suddenly now public enemy number one of the right?
Well, it really is. And what makes it especially distressing is that Pat Leahy had the most responsible coalition with robust libertarians on the right. Pat Leahy was working with people like Bob Barr of Georgia and with the National Rifle Association. It was a very respectable left-right coalition of the most inspiring kind.
Gentlemen, I want to get one more call in here. Gene is on the line. And Gene, we want to hear from you. Are you there?
Yes, I am. I really liked what John said. I'm very concerned about sort of this. I feel like it's a panic stampede and kind of this willingness to kind of this wholesale turning over to the government any ideas, anything that wants, you know, that that is put forward in terms of, you know, trying to protect people.
You're afraid it'll go too far then?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, I also think, you know, that this country is not, you know, if you give that much power and you keep building on it because, you know, our technological expertise keeps growing and deepening. And to me, it seems like you're going towards a phase where you could just control so much that it's mind-blowing.
Gene, that's the fear, and we got your call. We're running out of time, but thanks very much for it. Jeffrey Rosen, final thoughts?
Absolutely. John put so beautifully the idea that we usually are expected to identify ourselves for discrete purposes, but not be known to the government in all of our complexity. And I think Jeannie very powerfully reminds us that there's a tendency toward increasing social control. These technologies have a way of being used for purposes very different from those that they're installed for, and she reminds us to be quite careful before we allow our society to be transformed with little security.
And Jack Beatty, are you ready for the camera to poke in through your window?
No, I'm not. But
you
I'm
suspicious
about to become,
character, you?
But I'm about to become a resident of the state of New Hampshire, and I'm going to have one of those license plates that say "Live Free or Die."
Live Free or Die. I don't know.
I don't want that says. I don't want the one that says "Live Free and Die."
Yeah, that's the one we don't want. But what
that's
would
the one we don't want?
But what would Benjamin Franklin make of it all? Jeffrey Rosen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jeffrey Rosen is associate professor at George Washington University Law School and legal affairs editor of The New Republic. And Jack Beatty, good to have you as always.
Good to be here.
You can read Jeffrey Rosen's article, A Watchful State, that started this whole debate on our website. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. Now, some low-tech face recognition. George Barsum immigrated from Syria 11 years ago. He's not Muslim, he's Christian, and he says, an American patriot. But those who see him on the street or at his job in Providence, Rhode Island, in a Providence, Rhode Island bakery, sometimes see nothing more than his dark skin and hair.
I'm very fearful to go out and, like, when people ask me, what nationality are you, I'm afraid to tell them what I am. They might hold it against me. So most of the time when people ask me what I am, I usually tell them I'm Italian. Because I look very much Italian. I don't have a Middle Eastern accent at all. I'm Aramaic. It's like almost the first like form of Christianity in the Middle East. But like after these incidents, it's changed everybody's perspective about like Middle Eastern people. And there was one incident, I think it was maybe the second day after the attacks. There was some fellow out here, and he saw me pulling out, and he was looking at me real weird, and he was saying, "God bless America." And I told him, "Yeah, God bless America." I don't think he meant it in a very, you know, polite way towards me. He probably thought I was Muslim, and he was trying to, like, verbally attack me, you know. I mean, all my family's affected. I'm afraid about my father when he comes to work over here. Somebody may attack him when he goes outside. I mean, my mother has a store. And all her customers that go in there, they always asking her, "Are you Muslim? Are you this?" She tells them, "No, I'm Christian. I'm Aramaic." I think these events will probably calm down in people's hearts about like our neighbors around here, but they're not going to forget what happened, and they shouldn't. My feelings towards Muslims, most of them, the extremists, haven't changed because I left my country because of them. My ancestors were taken out by the Ottoman Empire in 1914, and they were all slaughtered for no reason because they were Christian. They were taken out of their homes, and they were just shot. And that's, I don't know, I guess that's their jihad. But they say that their jihad is only in defense. I have a lot of Muslim friends, to tell you the truth. Most of my friends condemn these acts. They live here now. They're like a part of here. I mean, people, if you're in this country and you don't like this country, take an airplane and get out. You know, what are you doing here? And I left my country because I was persecuted, to tell you the truth. I came in search of freedom. And if they tell me, hold up arms and defend freedom, I'll be the first one to join. But I have faith in my government to, like, solve all these problems. It may take a year, 2 years from now, but let them do whatever they, like, or let the government do whatever they have to do just to get everything under control.
George Barsum lives in Providence, Rhode Island. We'd like to hear from you. How has your life changed since September 11th? How is the air war over Afghanistan now going to ground? Or the anthrax scare? Or talk of new surveillance here in the United States affecting you? Send your submissions for future radio diaries by email to special@wbur.org. You can read or listen to other radio diaries on our website. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston.